Bienvenidos! It's the Pop-matic Podcast for September 14th, 2016. Coming to you from the Special Collection Center at the Main Library in downtown Nashville, it's the Pop-matic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Jeremy, and joining me today are...
A well-rested Bill.
Miguel.
Sarah.
Linda.
So, September 15th to October 15th is National Hispanic Heritage Month. This is a trans month celebration of, you guessed it, Hispanic heritage. It starts on the 15th of September to coincide with the independence of five Latin American countries, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. And there will be programs at libraries all throughout our system, all across the county, all month long. So be sure to check out our website for details, or you can pick up the latest issue of Unbound, our print calendar, for more information. And today we're going to talk about some of our favorite Hispanic items in our collection. Amanda.
Yes, Jeremy.
What would you like to tell us about this week?
Okay, well, last year on the Hispanic Heritage episode, I talked about John Leguizamo, and I promised to return this year with Johnny Legs 2.0. So, you know, since
this is the well that keeps on giving.
Since I never forget my promises, this year I'm going to talk more about John Leguizamo. So last year I mentioned his biography, Pimps, Hoes, Playa Haters, and all the rest of my Hollywood friends, which is just a really hard title to say. So in this book, John talks about his life growing up and how he became an actor. Now, before I read it, I didn't realize that John had done so much stage work in the theater. He'd actually written and starred in several one-man plays on and off Broadway. Now, this may come as a shock to you, but I do not live in Brooklyn.
What? Really?
I don't. So, full disclosure, he did try out a few shows in Chicago before moving them to New York, but I don't live there either. So, this means that I didn't get to see any of his one-man shows, which, according to most of the things I've read, say that they are some of his best work. Now, luckily, the library has a book called The Works of John Leguizamo that includes the standardized script for his four shows, which this include Freak, Spikorama, Mambo Mouth, and Sexaholics. So I say standardized script because John is well known for improvising as much of his material as possible. So the book might not actually, you know, probably definitely won't be exactly what was performed. John and his fellow show writer slash producer for Freak, David Barkatz, even put a disclaimer in the beginning that says, "The show was written to be performed, but it has been adapted here to be a joyous read. Right now we're in the midst of the show's developmental process, and this version represents where the show is at this exact moment, which happened to be June 19th, 1997. It will be different tomorrow and even more different the day after. We only tell you this because if you try to read along with the book to a performance, you're going to get really confused." Which I would totally have tried. But anyway, so I still wish I could have seen him perform these shows live. I know that he can be a little vulgar with language and subject material, but it comes from a place of truth. That was his experience growing up as a Colombian immigrant in New York in the 60s and 70s. So maybe one day I'm hoping he will bring one of his shows to Nashville and I might actually get to see it. But until then, at least I get to read it. Sarah?
I liked it when he played Luigi. No, that's his least favorite movie too. I'm sure. I'm sure.
Like he turned down something else really big to take that role, wrecked his life to take that role, and like he's like,
shame.
I made money, but
you know, and you know he in the 20th anniversary, 30th or whatever anniversary of the movie, he did a special live stream to all the Super Mario Brothers fans.
Really?
Because apparently there's websites of people with no taste and, you know, are brain dead on beds that, you know, have been in comas to enjoy that film.
I think the money that he made, he made a ton of money from that movie, and I think that it went to fund one of these other shows.
Well, I guess, you know, weeping with rage as a child is, you know, a totally normal thing.
Kill all men.
All right, okay. My celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month is by taking it back about 13, 14 years ago to required reading for high school English. You're probably already familiar with this book and author, but just in case, allow me to introduce you to The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros, a Chicago native with Mexican roots. On top of having written two novels, Cisneros has also written a collection of short stories, two books of poetry, and lastly, a children's book. Especially for the coming-of-age novel The House on Mango Street and adult fiction Caramello, her recent fiction novel, Cisneros drew the inspiration for her work from her very own life and childhood. Having been raised in a family as the only daughter with six brothers, where that family traveled frequently between Chicago and Mexico, Cisneros understood the feeling of not completely belonging to either culture. The similarity of the character's life and the feeling of not belonging is ever present in The House on Mango Street. So is also the feeling of not wanting to belong, specifically in the harsh and realistic world that she knows as home. The main character, Esperanza Cordero, narrates her story, and it comes to the reader through a series of vignettes from a girl that does not like her home on Mango Street, though it's the first home their parents ever owned, and she vows to leave one day. Esperanza wants to change her name to Zizi the X because she does not like her name. It's bad luck, she says, and only reflects sadness. In English, she says it means hope, but in Spanish, she says it means too many letters. That familiar feeling as a teenager or adolescent where you dislike all that is yours because the grass is greener elsewhere is very much present in all of Esperanza's thoughts. And I don't mean that in a judgmental way. The many circumstances that Esperanza is forced to deal with and live through are pretty tough. Her quote-unquote hope, remember, that's what her name means, is to dream a little bigger for herself. Throughout the book, as Esperanza grows a little older and a little more mature in a year, many different experiences, both good and bad, begin to shape her plan of leaving Mango Street one day. She begins to write as a means of expressing herself and views it as the vehicle which will someday allow her to leave Mango Street. In the end, that desire is still strong, but she also realizes that she'll come back again one day to help those that couldn't leave. Another coming-of-age novel I read in high school that still remains to be a personal favorite is The Catcher in the Rye. Well, this isn't that story, nor are Holden Caulfield and Esperanza similar characters. So if you're looking for a little edgier teenage angst, this isn't it. But if you're looking for another story that somewhat deals with the meaning of life or the search for a better one, this is a good quick read that's beautifully written as if from a child's naive perspective, but still profoundly influential. And of course, the library has it in a variety of formats. Mike?
I like mangoes. Today.
That's what you took from that. You like mangoes.
Well, it's better than my response. I'll take it. Yeah. I just took it down a notch for.
Mangoes are good.
Totes bums. Today, I thought I'd like to talk about some of the works of the internet's resident boyfriend, Oscar Isaac. Isaac was born in Guatemala in 1979. His family moved to Florida shortly after he was born. As an aside, I've always found sentences like this odd. Well, I remember a bio of another Isaac Asimov, that began with a sentence that had something like, Asimov was born in the Soviet Union, but while still a baby, he drug his parents, kicking his scribby to the United States.
Oh, my God.
It's like that. But Oscar Isaac, the person I'm talking about today, went back and forth about, you know, maybe being an actor or maybe being a musician until he was accepted to the famed school at Juilliard. He's been in a few movies, and some of them quite good. Ex Machina came out last year, and Bill gushed about it mightily, as longtime listeners may remember. So I will not go into too much detail here. I'll just say that, you know, Donald Gleason plays a computer programmer selected by a reclusive billionaire inventor to chat about a sexy android. Oscar Isaac plays Nathan, a kind of Mark Zuckerberg / Frankenstein, who's a brogrammer. I've heard of, you know, he's all out, you know, rah, bro, who is obsessed with the idea of physical pleasure. He is constantly eating or drinking or exercising or, you know, devising ways to create a perfect sex life. It's all very physical. In a most violent year, Isaac plays Abel Morales, an immigrant and small business owner trying to survive during the most violent year in New York history. As the film progresses, both you and he gradually begin to realize that he's been duped by his enemies, his friends, and even his wife for years. Ooh, it's a pretty great performance in a movie that exists. There's so little violence that I think even Evil Robot would dig it. Small children could watch it and feel nothing. And finally, in Inside Llewyn Davis, Oscar Isaac plays the titular character, a folk musician in early 1960s New York City. Davis is a selfish jerk who ruins every single relationship he has, from his sister to his friends to his patrons to strangers to even an adorable cat. Oh, even the kitty. Frowny face. He poops on everybody and everything, presumably for his art.
The cat or Oscar?
It is art, so.
How about them cubs?
He makes kitty litter sculptures. It's great. It is 2 hours of burning bridges. But the music is great, and his performance is really memorable. I've heard that Coen Brothers movies lately could be seen as like pairs, as like the serious one and the comedy one have like parallel kind of storylines, and it makes it really interesting. Like with Hail Caesar, you know, it's very kind of similar, but that one is about a person who like is forming bridges and forming relationships, and you know, is not an artist, and I liked it better. And you know, Oscar Isaac was also a pilot in some Star Wars movie for something, and he's the bad guy in some X-Men movie. But, you know, so anyway, Oscar Isaac, he's a really great actor. He has a knack for cheesy memorable roles. I hope to see more of his work in the future.
He does bad well.
Yeah. We got Bill.
Well, I'm moving into Jeremy's territory this morning. I'm going to be talking about playwright and comic book writer Roberta Aguirre-Sacasa, who wrote Afterlife with Archie and The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. In these two graphic novels, he takes the kids of Riverdale's and the Archie comic and puts his own diabolical spin on it. Mr. Sacasa says himself Afterlife with Archie was about Lovecraft and zombie and body horror. Chilling Adventures of Sabrina would be more psychological, a bit more subtle, but only a bit. A bit more sexual, as stories with witches often are. There would be less humor than Afterlife with Archie, which strives for a Sam Raimi vibe. This would be more like Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist and The Omen, a dark occult coming-of-age story. Speaking of coming-of-age, Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa was born in Washington, D.C., the son of a Nicaraguan diplomat, and raised in both the U.S. and Central America. His love of comics came when his mother would take him to the 7-Eleven for comic books. I highly recommend both Afterlife with Archie, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. Also on order, Afterlife with Archie, Betty, R.I.P. Also, Mr. Sacasa is involved with the new show Riverdale, which will air this fall on the CW. Jeremy.
Suddenly want to see Riverdale. Sounds infinitely more interesting than I thought it would be.
So it's going to take a darker side.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to it.
I guess he's forced to choose Veronica now to restart the population after the fall of man.
That's true.
I really like that Sabrina book a lot. I mean, I liked Afterlife with Archie, too, but I really liked Sabrina.
Yeah, I read it on my pop culture stay vacation.
That was nice. And now for something completely different, I guess. So today I'm going to talk about a book by a guy.
No way!
Sorry. But that's it.
I'm not sure.
I'm done.
Now I'm talking about a book by a lady. Will she be too pretty to write?
Wow. It's going to get us flagged, man.
So we'll get some stats now.
Yeah, that's right.
So the man is Luis Alberto Urrea, and he is a Mexican-American author of poetry, nonfiction, novels, and memoir. He was born in Tijuana, Mexico, to a Mexican father and an American mother. And his hometown is the primary focus of the book, Across the Wire, Life and Hard Times on the Mexican Border. So in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and then on up, I think this book was published in 93 or so, Urrea worked with a missionary group which brought food, clothes, and other necessities to impoverished people living in Tijuana. Many of these people had been heading toward the U.S. From Central America or other places in Mexico, and then kind of stopped at the border either because they were turned back or they ran out of money or they got in trouble with the police or they got sick or any number of other reasons. So he took these experiences that he and the things that he saw and then wrote this amazing book about what he saw there. So here's what the book isn't about. It's not about the nobility of white people or I guess half white people making runs south of the border to help poor people. There's a leader of the missionary group. His name's Pastor Vaughn. He kind of is in the book, plays a small role. he at one point he got scabies, and rather than get it treated and taken care of, he just let it flourish on his body so he could better understand the people that he was serving. And he also made sure that the teeny, he called them teeny bopper Bible school girls, that when they went into the homes of these people who he knew that they would see people, lice, feces, blood, pus, all kinds of horrible stuff. Yeah. But he wanted to make sure that they respected these people and treated them as people. But like I said, it's not about his nobility, because he always goes home back to the U.S. and lives like a king compared to the people that he's trying to help. So what Urrea's book is about is a series of portraits of all kinds of people living in really the worst conditions possible, just a few short miles from the prosperity of America. So these are people they've settled in garbage dumps of Tijuana and built homes for themselves out of discarded construction supplies and other sort of just like detritus that they find everywhere. They burn wood and paper and broken ovens to cook their meals, and they collect water in rusty barrels and contract diseases, which most of us in the U.S. associate with colonial times or times way, way, way far in the past. So it's a very heavy read. There's some particularly upsetting stuff about pregnant women and babies that even I had a difficult time reading, and I, as you knew from last week, I don't like animals, so I have no heart.
All right.
And so just, reading the book makes me think about the border, and obviously, because that's what it's about. So in the U.S., within the U.S., we travel across borders all the time, county lines, state lines, whatever, time zones. And the only obvious differences are like the amount of sales tax that we pay, or the conditions of the rest areas. But my own experience driving through or around the U.S.-Mexico border between El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. So, like, you're driving down the highway, and on your left, you see Texas, and there's like lights and shopping centers or whatever. And then on the other side, it's just hillsides covered in shacks. And it's a really, it's a humbling, or I don't know what the right word is, but it's a shock to kind of see. So so the border obviously gets a lot of attention these days. It's a really fascinating kind of place which sort of transcends campaign rhetoric and demagoguery. And there's all talk of building a wall. But of the top five walls of all time, only two of those walls are still standing. I will now list the top five walls of all time. Number five, Hadrian's Wall.
Oh, yeah. Okay, we're doing this.
Taking it old school.
Awesome. Yeah, Hadrian's Wall is pretty cool.
I think at one time it might have been pretty mighty. These days I could probably jump over it. Very weak. number four, the Berlin Wall. It's a symbol of oppression. Not a good wall.
Probably also, not try to jump over that one.
Also, also came
but
down.
8x9 Berliner meant I'm a donut, which I enjoy quite a lot.
Yes, that's excellent. Also, that wall, gone. Number three, Walls of Jericho, knocked down by trumpets. Very weak.
Not good. It did take seven trips around, though.
That's true.
Yeah.
Very bad, though, still. Trumpets, music,
all
walls.
All I know is the wrestling move by Chris Jericho.
That's the bottom line.
I can smell what you're cooking.
Stone Cold said so. Diamond Dallas Page. Number two, the Great Wall of China. Now, that's a pretty great wall.
Number two?
Number two.
Wow.
You can see it from space. That's pretty rad.
I'm on the edge of my
pretty
seat.
Rad. Now, the Great Wall of China, I don't know where it starts in China, but it's like it starts, so you could just kind of go around it. So not a lot of protection on that end. However, it does end in the sea, and that's pretty rad.
They had a big beef with Mongolia.
The Mongols weren't that smart, so.
They had a beef with Mongolia. Good Lord.
Szechuan.
I don't think you heard that one. Szechuan.
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. And the number one.
Mandarin.
The number one wall of all time. Pink Floyd's The Wall. And that's just a symbol of isolation, depression, oppression, and mental illness. We don't need no education. What I'm saying is big walls.
Walls are bad.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
What?
Honorable walls, wallabies for Gary from Perth.
Yeah, big walls don't do much of anything but fall down.
Hello, walls.
And really, if you go to the border, there is a wall that's there.
Wallace Simpson.
You just kind of have to be a decent person to see it.
Hey, guys.
Oh, that's right. It's been a while.
Hey, yeah. Co-host Mike.
Hey, random dude. Hey.
I had something and then I lost it. Sorry. Hey, Mike.
Oh, hey, Jeremy.
Hey, everybody.
What's up?
Hey.
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well,
maybe the library has it.
Maybe the library no tango.
It's Tickle My Fancy.
Amanda?
Okay, so did you get enough of Hispanic Heritage Month with our regular segment? No? Good, because I've got more. Yay. So just when you thought I was done with John Leguizamo, I bring you one last item. So most
the
of
best.
The best. I saved the best for last.
Jeez. Carlita's way.
That would be funny if that was true. So most of John's shows I talked about previously happened in the late 90s or early aughts. Then he took a break to do a few movies here and there. Maybe you saw a couple, you know, Ice Age, Chef. But in 2011, John came back to what he loved and started working on a new one-man show with his former producer, Fisher Stevens. Fun fact, as an actor, Stevens is best known for what role?
The guy from Short Circuit?
Oh, I don't think about that. I was thinking about he was on Early Edition. He was the best friend on Early Edition with Kyle Chandler.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's true.
Huh? That's where I met him.
Bad guy from Hackers.
So
serial killer.
I don't watch that show. So
you haven't seen Hackers?
No,
it's a terrible movie. That's great.
I've seen that. I'll put that on my list.
Johnny Lee Miller?
Yes.
So the new work that John was working on was not the Mario Brothers movie. It was...
It's a sequel.
Oh, dear God.
More mushrooms. So anyway, the new work he was working on involved into the show he called Ghetto Clown. And this show would eventually win John a drama desk, which I had never heard of before. But apparently they've been awarded to New York Theater Productions on or off Broadway since 1955. So I'm the one not in the know on that. So John also took the show to HBO, where he adapted it for TV. Now, the library has a DVD documentary called John Leguizamo, Tales from a Ghetto Clown, which shows his process behind the show. It doesn't actually show the show, which is sad because I wish I could see it. But the reason that I'm here today is to tell you about a different adaptation, and I'm talking about Ghetto Clown, the graphic novel.
What?
Because they'll make a graphic novel out of anything.
Back to Jeremy territory.
I know. It's my new thing. So John decided that this latest work of his would work well in pictorial form because it could help the audiences who don't actually get to see his live shows, you know, i.e. us, to feel more included in his story. Plus, he said that, you know, in graphic novels, being able to get any perspective, any point of view, or any angle is amazing. It's even more freeing than film because there you always have a budget to worry about. But when working with a graphic artist, whether you're going for a close-up of an eye or a New York City street filled with cabs and crowds and tenements, it's probably going to cost you the same amount. So on the page, the only limitation is your imagination.
Yeah.
So for us, the only unfortunate limitation is that the library doesn't officially own a copy.
Well.
But luckily, I'd be happy to request you copy through interlibrary loan, and I'd also shout out to Nashville State for sending me their copy so I could read it. Thanks for sharing. But so now John needs to go make 15 more Ice Age movies so I have something to talk about next year for Hispanic Heritage Month.
Oh, boy.
Something to look forward to. I was about to say, we still haven't touched Ice Age yet.
Yeah, really.
You could do one a year for the next 3 or 4 years.
I could.
Son of Sam.
He's the Sloth. Not on Son of Sam.
He did one of the George Romero movies. Land of the Dead, I think.
He's the Sloth.
Yeah.
He's awesome.
All righty.
Sarah.
Yes.
I'm just going to talk like Sloth.
Try that the entire show, yes. Yeah. All right. Well, I made a major boo-boo in not discussing this show last week for Fantasy Week, but I won't make that same mistake twice.
Boo-boo.
As we all know by now, the Netflix original show Stranger Things has taken the country, world, and every dimension in between by storm.
Something is coming. Something hungry for blood.
What is it?
The Demogorgon!
We're deep shit!
Now we have to go.
Later.
See you tomorrow.
Good night, ladies.
Kiss your mom night for me.
Will is missing. I don't know where he is.
99 out of 100 times kid goes missing, the kid is with a parent or a relative.
What about the other time?
What?
You said 99 out of 100. What about the other time? The one! The one!
Will! Will!
Guys, I really think we should turn back.
Did you guys hear that?
That's not Will. You're in trouble, aren't you?
You've sealed off this area.
This is where it came from?
Yes.
And the girl?
She can't have gone far.
Find her.
Do you really think it was a coincidence that we found her the same place where Will disappeared?
Something is going on here!
What the hell?
She knows about Will!
Is there any way that you could reach him?
Yes.
What if this whole time I've been looking for Will? I've been chasing after something else.
The promptly named show of nostalgic and horrific proportions premiered July of this year, and the way I thought of it was like if you combine some of the scenery and elements of The Goonies with a dash of Stephen King and The X-Files, you have this show. But it's also in a world of its own, pretty literally. It's not just the storyline that sucks you in immediately. It's the 1980s time frame that is too perfect to be real, the casting that the creators managed to keep somewhat low-key, minus Winona Ryder and a few others.
Matthew Modine.
Mm-hmm.
It's all sad face in the corner.
And it's also the synth awesomeness of the soundtrack that makes it era-perfect for the show. Why you should watch this show, you ask, since I've given you no hints at what the storyline is? Well, that's because I really don't want to give anything away. But I can say it involves a missing kid, a different found kid, Dungeons and Dragons, and the government. In that order. Exactly.
Wow. That's pretty succinct.
You that's need good. To watch this show because the story progression is too addictive not to share. Trust me, I got my brother hooked on it, and he's someone that's usually pretty picky about his shows, and he loved it. His comparison of the show was to Twin Peaks, but he said this was better and not too drawn out.
Evil robot has busted the circuit, yeah. You know. Is that smoke coming died. From his pedantic circuits?
Peaks. those are his words.
Well, it has the luxury. Stranger Things has the luxury of existing in this moment of television where you don't have to draw things out. So that's...
Yeah, mm-hmm. You can make something quirky and niche and don't have to worry about, like, you know...
Advertising dollars.
Yeah, exactly. You know, stretching it for 12 seasons till it dies.
Mm-hmm.
Or 1.5 seasons, I guess.
That's the thing might be. Well, I haven't seen Twin Peaks. That was just my brother's assessment.
Dude!
I know.
It's okay.
Dude! I've watched 2 episodes.
You know that about me.
Dude.
You're not shocked at that.
Hey.
Do yourselves a favor. Come on.
But you just said it was drawn out.
Yeah.
This is a horrible show. You should totally watch
it. But it's amazing. It's not... I mean, it's been a while since I've seen the second season. The second season is like... Maybe sandwiched in the middle is like, come on, what's happening? And then it's like, awesome. And it has the best ending of television history, right? As you said, right? Best ending of a TV show ever.
Kill all men.
Anyway, back to my point. My brother and I only differ on how we think the second season should go of Stranger Things, not Twin Peaks. But that's the cool part. It's already been confirmed that there will be a second season. Oh, and another fun tidbit. A few of the child actors from the show were on Jimmy Fallon recently and played a strange game where they each had to read a statement on a piece of paper that included a truth about another person playing. And they had to guess which person it belonged to at the table. Millie Bobby Brown, found kid, and the most intriguing character on the show, I think, rap some Nicki Minaj lyrics to the song Monster during this part. Apparently that was her truth.
Pull up in that monster automobile gangster with a bad that came from Sri Lanka. Yeah, I'm in a town the color of Willy Wonka. You can be the king, but watch the queen conquer. First things first, I'll eat your brains. Then I'm gonna start rocking gold teeth and fangs. Cause that's what a monster do. Hey, that's a fumble, and that's a monster do.
So these kids are clearly talented. So do yourself a favor. If you have Netflix, hopefully the library is able to order this series at some point. But find yourself a box of Eggos and settle down for an interesting 8-episode ride. Mike?
My sister has seen it from beginning to end 6 times. She Whoa. Cosplayed at Dragon Con as Dustin. She got like black wax and covered like their top teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And,
really?
Like, had the hat and like a wig, and she's carrying around pudding.
Do you have a picture?
Nice. Yeah, it's on my Facebook feed. I can probably send it.
That is pretty awesome. I want to dress up as Barb for Halloween. I think I could do
that. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's engulfed my Facebook feed and all my friends. And since I'm a contrarian, I'm going to burn it down.
I wonder if Matthew Modine's hair, though, was it?
Oh, yeah.
Is it his hair now?
Oh, yeah. It's like bright white.
It's like, white, man. And you notice he didn't say a word until like episode 6 or something.
Pretty much.
It was just present.
Yeah.
How do I get a role like that?
That's right.
I can just sit in the corner.
Mm-hmm. Maybe he's still being punished for the pirate movie.
But it's funny, they talked about Vision Quest. I don't know if this was intentional. In one episode, they were talking about Vision Quest, and he was in a movie called Vision Quest.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of references in the show.
Yeah.
What's that pirate movie called?
Oh. Cutthroat Island.
Cutthroat Island.
Thank you.
Yeah, somebody had to burn for that, and I guess it's Matthew Modine's career, because he disappeared after that, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much.
He was on Weeds.
Well, now we know where he went.
Well, there you go, yeah.
He went to work for the government.
Right.
Yeah, he got kicked off movies, and, you know, but he'll always be remembered for Full Metal Jacket.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so I thought I'd like to recommend a charming little comedy I saw at the Belcher recently called Hunt for the Wilder People. It's about a boy named Ricky Baker who goes to live with foster parents in rural New Zealand. When tragedy strikes, he goes to live in the forest with his foster uncle, played by Sam Neill.
Wow. Sam Neill?
Yeah, Sam Neill, with a weird New Zealand accent. See also Possession.
Ricky Baker.
He is a baddie, a youth court regular.
We're hoping that this change of scene will help straighten him out.
You hungry? That's a silly question, isn't it? Look at you.
Ricky Baker, now you are 13 years old. You are a teenager and you're as good as gold.
Ricky, this is Heck. You can call him uncle if you like.
No, I can't.
Bella told me to tell you that you should give me something to do. Is there anything you want me to do?
Yeah. Leave me alone.
Cool. You ever been up in that jungle before?
There's about 1,000,000 hectares of it, buddy. It's easy to get lost.
You lost? I'm amazed how lost you got.
You little bastard!
We got no choice but to camp out here for a few weeks.
Where are you, Ricky Baker?
More on this massive national manhunt.
Faulkner is Caucasian. Well, they got that wrong because you're obviously white.
You're going to jail, you pervert.
What you call me?
A pervert.
Back up, homies, and let go of my uncle! So what do we do now?
We run. No, we don't need to run.
Huh? Oh, yeah, this is fast walk.
Gonna be rough. No huts, no tents, real bush life. And if you play up, I dump you.
Okay, Uncle.
I'd still prefer if you don't call me Uncle.
Sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
What's the fastest way out of here?
Jetpack!
Do you actually have a jetpack?
No? What?
We're offering $10,000 to anyone who can capture them, dead or alive. Alive. They should be alive.
Crumpy!
She's a bit bumpy around here.
Love you, Ricky.
Ricky!
Ricky! Isn't that Alex who did this? Tell them it was the water people.
The water people?
I'll never stop running.
Yeah, and I'll never stop chasing you. I'm relentless. I'm like the Terminator.
I'm more like Terminator than you.
I said it first. You're more like Sarah Connor. In the first movie, too, before she could do chin-ups.
Their adventures in living off the land provokes a lot of humor, but also some sad bits. Ricky Baker is set up to be like a really bad kid, but from what the movie shows, he just seems to be a normal kid. I guess his social worker just despises him to like a humorously absurd degree. I also liked that there's like half the cast is Maori, but like they make no big deal about that. And I also especially liked Rhys Darby plays a crazy hermit. I love that guy. He can do anything.
Did he direct it too, or write it?
No, that was Taika Waititi.
Okay.
Who, as I'm about to say, this is Taika Waititi's follow-up movie to What We Do in the Shadows, which longtime listeners may remember me gushing about multiple times last year. He's currently directing the third Thor movie, so I expected it to be an hour and a half of majestical awesomeness, followed by a blah half hour to an hour where I tried to choke on the last few kernels in my popcorn bag just to know what it's like to feel again. Much like every other Marvel movie.
Hey, except Mark. Deadpool.
Well, that's not a Marvel. That's Marvel, not technically movie. Marvel, though.
That's true.
That's a Sony movie. Using Marvel characters.
It's a Marvel character.
Gag me.
Explains a lot.
Hey, Mark, everybody and their grandmother's like, Guardians of the Galaxy, it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. An hour and a half into it, I was like, this is great. And then, oh, no, there's another. Oh, no. Why is it going?
An hour and a half.
Why do you keep going? Why? Why? It's so good.
I kept waiting for it to get funny.
I don't know. It's like the older I get, the more, less my attention span goes. Anything over an hour and a half is just like, why are we here?
Yeah. What's your window? What? 90 minutes.
Yeah,
done.
Yeah, exactly. Every movie could be 90 minutes.
You should move to
minutes.
Vegas. Everything in Vegas
Did
is 90
say
minutes.
Did you don't breathe?
Yeah, don't.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, wait. No, I haven't seen it. But I mean to see it.
I heard that was good.
Me too. Anyway, what do you got, Bill?
Well, Tickling My Fancy is a young adult novel called With Malice by Elaine Cook. In brief, 18-year-old Jill Sharon wakes up in a hospital with her leg in a cast, stitches on her face, and a case of amnesia in which she can't remember the past 6 weeks of her life. She was involved in a car wreck, but is there something more?
Dun, dun, dun.
With Malice by Elaine Cook. I highly recommend it. I don't want to give too much away. Just trust me. Read it. It's a great brief read. Jeremy.
Tickling My Fancy is a book by a guy.
Again?
Again.
You have a theme for the day.
Yeah,
I like
dudes
it.
Dudes are
dudes. Dudes, yeah.
Yeah, there was some thing of people like challenging themselves to read all female authors 1 year. Like, were you doing that?
Yeah, Brian did that.
And then, like, I realized, like, man, you should maybe try some of that because I read a lot of books by dudes. But I read this book, The Heavenly Table by Donald Ray Pollock. It was very good. This is his third book. The first is a collection of short stories called Knock 'em Stiff, and they kind of all take place in this small town in southern Ohio called Knock 'em Stiff. The second book is a novel called The Devil All the Time, and it all takes place in this small town in Ohio called The Devil All the Time. That's a joke. Those are both contemporary pieces.
I laugh at everything, and I didn't laugh at that.
They're kind of about like... poor people and some poor decision making. The Heavenly Table takes place around the time of World War I, and there's a military base that's being built near Chillicothe, Ohio. I think I maybe have that wrong. Anyway, so there's these three brothers, and their father is this hardworking guy who believes in making himself and his family suffer so they can enjoy heaven in the afterlife. And fortunately, he dies. And then the brothers become outlaws inspired by a dime novel that only one of them knows how to read. And then so they go on the spree, and then their lives sort of intersect with this farmer who's lost everything to a swindler and a man who's traveling from the south back to Kentucky, to Kentucky to see his family. And then there's a guy who is a serial killer, basically. And there's a lot of brutal violence. Oh, there's also a army man who is a closeted homosexual who gets into some trouble. And all these stories kind of circle around, which is like my favorite thing. I'm making little circles in the air. They all circle in around till they intersect at the end. It's a very good book. Like all his other books, it is brutal and violent and sometimes makes me cringe, but that's what I like. So read The Devil All the Time, and then you can read the other book that I'm talking about, the book that I'm actually talking about, The Heavenly Table by Donald Ray Pollock.
No comic books, but just books written by dudes.
Dukes written by boobs. corrections. Does anyone have corrections?
I don't have a correction, but I have an addendum.
Okay.
So we talked about Once Upon a Time last week. We talked about the library in Storybrooke, Maine.
Uh-huh.
So I got to the last episode of the season where they go into the library in Storybrooke, Maine. And apparently they've been holding Maleficent as a dragon in the basement. So that was very exciting. Now, I can't say that we do that
I like the sound
here.
Of this.
Well, I can't say that we do
I work
that
with some dragons in the basement.
Here. Well, I was going to say, because the only person in the basement here is Mike, and I don't think he turns into a dragon. But
so you say.
I haven't seen him early in the morning.
Yeah, that's right. I say I'm a cataloger. Really, I'm a dark worm.
Yep.
So that was my exciting library story.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. We got a listener email from a Lieutenant Commander Spock. Looks like it came over subspace. Jesus. This says confirmation that Midnight Oil is from Australia was an in-show correction. Therefore, talking about the in next week's correction segment was an error. Looks like Lieutenant Commander Spock needs to get some logic back into his email typing. I think he's just saying like we don't need to talk about it.
About it for the third week in a row.
Sure. Yeah.
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 Well, listen to Midnight Oil, gang.
Well,
are those beds burning?
They are because we're not getting enough sleep and therefore we can't form our thoughts correctly. Also, the clip at the beginning of the show was from Gentlemen Broncos featuring Jemaine Clement as Ronald Chevalier. This is a Popmatic favorite. He's one of the patron saints of the podcast. So anything else?
I finished Harry Potter.
Nice. Excellent.
Didn't answer the Teddy question, though, did it?
No, I did not. No, not at all.
I just noticed Bill spelled my name wrong here.
That's okay.
That's fine.
He spelled it phonetically. It's fine.
I was pushed this morning. I had to come in and do it. As long as I can read it.
That's right.
You know, exactly. I know. I do the same thing.
For more information about Bill returning from vacation, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Bean.
You can subscribe to the Popmatic Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS, please. Next week,
Gene Wilder.
You get nothing. You lose. Good day,
good
sir.
Good day, sir. I said good day.
I said good day.
'Bienvenidos, SL Podcast Popmatic para Septembrian. I can't do that. Never mind.
All right, come on. Can you read?
Is this really cool? Oh, really? Can I read?
Yeah, can you?
Can you host?
This is the guy who's
Angelina Jolie.
Like half a minute. Dissing people that like the Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
Movie. But you're like, Hackers is great. Yeah.
It's
awesome bad movie.
It's silly bad. Fun bad. Super Mario Brothers will make you pray for the sweet release of death and it will not come. As a small child, I was looking forward to Super Mario Brothers.
I was doing so good not talking on this.
Yeah, that's right. Outrage!
Evil robot!
Well, see, as a small child, I was not looking forward to Hackers with bated breath and hoping that this video game that I really loved would turn out to be great, and it turned out to be a piece of steaming garbage.
What would the Mario Brothers movie even be?
It'd be a fat plumber stopping mushroom people. It'd be great.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
I can't believe it didn't translate to live action. What are you talking
exactly.
about?
Exactly. Shoot fireballs at, like, turtles.
Okay.
Ludwig van Koopa.
So anyway...